tonight on Arena, bringing the Showband era to life in a play called The Huckle Buck and hearing the words of Under Milkwood spoken by the people of Sligo. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And to start this evening, some music to bring us back to the dance halls of yore. The inimitable sound of Brendan Boyer and the Royal Showband there, and Huckle Buck. A new immersive theatre show called Huckle Buck is to be the highlight of this year's Clonmel Junction Festival. This is a story of a couple called Ian and Maeve. They meet at a dance hall where the showbands played rock and roll, preaching Kiss Me Quick and Pelvic Thrusts, while their homes and churches were steeped in the sexual oppression of the time. The play was devised from interviews, conversations and testimonies of the people who attended those dances in the past. And it was all collated by Jack Reardon, who joins me now from our Limerick studios. And I don't know about you, Jack, but very few people up in this studio sitting still as we listen to the Huckle Buck there. It is hard not to bop along to it, isn't it?
I'm sat here in a booth by myself and I'm bopping along to it as well.
Glad to hear.
Yeah, it's impossible not to feel the hips going.
Yeah, absolutely. Although there is something kind of innocent about it as well when you listen closely to the lyrics. Talk to me a little bit about the play, The Huckle Buck, which is what you have written and directed or will be directing for the Clonmel Junction Festival. How did it come about, Jack?
So our poster reads, directed by the son of a Drum Keen couple, Drum Keen being the iconic dance hall of Limerick, where my mum and dad met in the 70s, mind you. But it's very much a love letter to both of them. It's their testimony as to how they met, and then obviously other interviews that we conducted with other dance hall patrons that have all culminated in, I may be biased, but an amazing piece of theatre, an incredible story, and the immersive aspect has really made it a joyous night out.
Well, I don't know, maybe your mother and father were dancing and hearing show bands in the 1970s, but this seems to be a little bit earlier than that, and you were quite definitely in the show band era. What was attractive about that music and that period in time for the telling of the play, telling of the story, Jack?
It was a word which continuously came up through interviews, was a phenomenon. It was this period of time in Ireland where change was palpable. You could see it in front of your eyes, and it had one of the greatest soundtracks of all of Irish history. It was so alive. Every time you met dance hall patrons and they talked about it, you could see in their eyes the youth and the nostalgia and the liberation of the time. So I think perfectly in the 60s is at the height of that, where you have the likes of Brendan Boyer, Dickie Rock, Joe Dolan. They're almost at that time moving to America. They've gotten that big in Ireland. So, yeah, to say phenomenon, I think, is the perfect word to describe it.
And your two characters here, Aina and Maeve, it really, we're in boy meets girl territory here for sure, aren't we? What are their backgrounds and what sort of families are they coming from and what sort of experience do they bring to this dance hall with them?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It is boy meets girl. We see a young man, an avid dance hall goer. He can list out 100 bands across the nation. And he's there for a good time. He's been there a good few times himself. He's travelled the country following his favourite bands. But on this night of the show, something different happens. Mm. And that is the character of Maeve walking in for the first time. She's a young woman who comes from a household which is ruled by what's preached on the Sunday. It's the patriarchy is very much alive in her household. She's practically snuck out of her house, all but for an understanding aunt. She wouldn't be there herself. So she's coming from a very different world from him, and it's how the two meet and that love begins.
And the minute she walks in, cue Joe Dolan.
Thank you. for me. He must have been in a beautiful mood to show the world what a woman could be.
There he is, the wonderful Joe Dolan, and you're such a good-looking woman. One of the songs that will be heard as part of the play we're speaking about this evening. The play is called The Huckle Book, and Jack Reardon, writer and director of the piece, is in our Limerick studio this evening. Same thing there, Jack. This time it was smiles that were on all of the faces up in this studio. I presume you couldn't help but smile as you listened to that.
Oh, stop. It just takes over the body. It's amazing.
Infectious stuff. But, you know, and it strikes me, so I've already played The Huckle Book. Good Looking Woman is in there. I'm looking down through some of the other songs that are part of the play as well. Viva Las Vegas, Make Me an Island, Jailhouse Rock, The Answer to Everything. Song after song after song. And I said this is an immersive experience. So the audience, are they just going to sit and watch other people dancing, or what's the plan?
So when our audience arrive, doors will open and a full-on dance hall will already be in progress. We have an incredible six-piece band who are era-inspired musicians themselves, put together by James O'Donovan, an amazing local performer and musician. And a six-piece band with an amazing frontman inspired by the Dickie Rock and Brendan Boyers of the world. We will have our set of dancers up already dancing, but it is their job to invite audience members up to dance themselves, dusting off the dancing shoes one last time. Obviously, if people don't want to dance, that's fine. They're welcome to sit down in our immersive seating style, which are our booths to the side and a balcony.
And have you all the boys or men on one side of the hall and all the girls and women on the other side of the hall, as was the case, obviously?
Absolutely. And we thought about it, of what would you do to be presented with the choice, but it absolutely features within the show, but you're very welcome to sit with your partner all the same if you come and see it.
You know, and it's a joke, and we get a great laugh out of it, and the music makes us smile, it makes us bop along. But part of the play that really struck me was the innocence of these two characters, Aina and Maeve. You know, Maeve really, it's her first dance, and she really is a very innocent young woman. And for all his chat, Aina is a softie behind all of that as well, and very frightened almost of the attraction that he feels for this girl. It was a very oppressive society that, where even the thought that you might want to hold somebody's hand was potentially an occasion of sin.
Well, that's it. And it's kind of petrifying to look back on that and to understand how felt that was and how real that was, how much power the state and church had over young lives. And my mom has an amazing line, which is, youth finds a way. And they did, and they found a way to survive and thrive, but all the same, what was internal for them, the shame, the guilt, the sin, as you said, that was felt, it was very tough to be young.
Yeah, where even something like a simple kiss could kind of throw people into a state of such panic that they had harmed their immortal souls, that it could potentially damage a relationship.
Well, that's it. And, you know, it was fear was preached. If kisses are frequent, enduring and ardent, there can be never any just reason for them.
Yeah, that's a quote.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of wild that you would be sat on a Sunday listening to that going, OK, well, I guess I can't be kissing anyone at the weekend.
Yeah, and in the story, as it's told in the play, is that I think it was a Christian brother who had that fear, that acronym, that was the way that these young men should be thinking about kisses. There's a real sense in the play as well that Aina and Maeve, you know, it could go wrong or it could go right for them. And I'm not saying which way, but I really feared for the kind of oppression that they had experienced, that it could leave them emotionally absolutely, you know, as voids and incapable of expressing any emotion, again, for fear of this occasion of sin. How important was that serious side of the story to you?
It was just as important as the fun. I think, as I said, that line from my mother of youth finds a way, you know, there had to be a reason for youth to need to find a way. And I think what the show hopefully captures really well is how much fight young people had and what they did in order to survive and thrive, as I said. But I think within the show, there's this kind of sense that but for choices made, you know, we could become anyone else. And for some young people, they made the perfect right choices and it worked out for them. And then for others, nothing that they did against themselves, you know, their lives panned out in different ways. And I think the play really plays with that.
And I think your own mother and father had an incident under the clock at Cleary's where so many things happened or didn't happen, where it was a near miss, was it?
That's absolutely right. So Mom and Dad would have met in Drumkeen, as I said, and decided to make a date for under Cleary's clock a week later. And unfortunately, there was some bad weather. And my grandfather said to my mother, no chance, not going out, it's too dangerous. And my dad waited and he waited and he waited and my mum never turned up. And our surname being Reardon, Mom thought the spelling was R-I-O-R, but we spell it R-E-A-R. And only for my aunt to say, do you know there's another way you can spell Reardon? And she took out the phone book and went through every Reardon in Limerick until she eventually got through. And dad said, well, we leave it there. So and my mom said, I don't think I'd like that. And 40 years later, they're about to get back from their holidays together. They're still best friends, still very much in love. It's an amazing true love story that we came from.
Give me the Kleenex quickly. That is an absolutely wonderful story. The other, I'll finish up with another bit of Joe before we finish. Joe Dolan, before we finish up. But I'm thinking about you know, all the boys on the one side and all the girls on the other side of the floor. The walk across the floor, the lonely walk across to ask for a dance and the hope that you mightn't be refused. I mean, not an easy thing to do, not as easy as swiping right or swiping left, which I believe is something that goes on in the modern day.
Well, that's it. I mean, imagine getting swiped left, except the whole town knows that you've been rejected. You know, there's a lot more stakes at it.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, if you get the yes, then everybody knows you've hit
the
it off with someone.
The whole town knows as well. Well, look, I love that story about your mum and dad. I'll finish up with a little bit of Make Me an Island and I'll give people details of where it's all happening and all the rest. But thanks for being with us this evening, Jack.
Thank you so much, Gervin Margot.
It's Fáilte Róth, Jack Reardon on Sin.
Different eyes, different size, different girls every day. Different names, different games, took my breath clean away.
Make Me an Island from Joe Dolan, yet another of the songs that will be part of Jack Reardon's plays. That's Jack, R-E-A-R-D-O-N. Don't ever forget that. Jack Reardon's play, The Hucklebuck, which will be at the Clonmel Junction Festival from July the 1st through until the 9th of this year. And you can get full details on junctionfestival.com. Siobhan McGowan comes from a long line of storytellers and she's carrying on that family gift. Her first and her debut novel, that is, The Trial of Lotta Ray, was critically acclaimed. And her new novel, The Graces, brings science and faith into a collision with each other. It's set in Dublin in the years before the Easter Rising, tells the story of Rosaline Moore, a young woman with a singular gift. And Siobhan is also in our Limerick studio on this Monday evening. And I'm just thinking there, Siobhan, you know, when Jack Reardon was talking about that moment of modernity and I suppose the old firm, if you like, rubbing up against each other in the story in his play, you have a kind of a modernity and the old form as well in your story, but you're in a different time in Ireland.
Yeah, so my story is set in the 1910, 1911, sort of it starts off in that part of Ireland. So starts off in the countryside and in County Clare, where Rosaline Moore is a woman who's gifted with the sight, is said to be touched by the graces like her grandmother. But Rosaline's gift is not seen so much as a gift or as a curse, because she sees things within her community that she shouldn't see. So she ends up running to Dublin, to her Aunt Ellen's house in Eccles Street in Dublin. And there she meets a group of mesmerists who at the time, of course, were kind of, I suppose, were considered modern. Hmm. And
maybe you'd just explain what a mesmerist is or was at the time.
OK, so they were a very popular spiritualist group in the 19th century. And they they did healings by energy. They thought by transferring energy they could heal. They didn't actually touch as such. They just kind of hovered their hands over the afflicted person. But they considered themselves kind of height of modernity, as you say.
And there was an actual a doctor Franz Mesmer, yeah. And that's where the mesmerist, that's where that name comes from.
That's right. Dr. Franz Mesmer was the guy that, I suppose, invented the whole technique, and he was German. And so that's where our word mesmerism actually comes from.
And the way you described your character Rosaline growing up in the countryside in Clare and then coming to Dublin because she could see too much,
yeah,
and then this kind of healing that she seems to be able to display and works on when she gets to Dublin, that sounds like something that either you have experienced or that there's a history of it or a story of it within your family. Have I imagined incorrectly in that case?
No, actually, the actual site... was said our own great grandmother Margaret Lynch was said to have had that sight. She did. This was about 1911, that the era in which the book is set. That she actually woke. She was from a farm in Tipperary, and you know she had 10 or 11 children, and she woke in the night, screeching basically, like sweating, screeching for fear for her son, her younger son Tommy, who was about 17. And she went down to his bed and she was crying and saying, "Tommy, I feel something awful. Something awful is going to happen to you." Well, you know, I mean, Tommy being 17 didn't take it too seriously. And anyway, she couldn't know what it was, but she just felt it was something terrible. And he went out with his brothers. And our family used to have an old thrashing machine that they used to take around to all the neighbours' houses, and all the men and all the neighbours would join in with the threshing and thrashing. And he, this day they went out to do that, this summer's day, and we don't know quite what happened, but Tommy must have tripped in front of the huge blade at the front of the machine, and he got caught up in it, and they carried his body, you know, away and put it in the field, but he died, you know, he died from that. And it wasn't long after my great-grandmother had seen something awful happening to him. So that I actually tell that story faithfully in the book, but I changed the names.
Yeah, so we get a sense of that. But so in some ways, was that a kind of an impetus to write this story? Because where you go with Rosaline is in a totally new direction then after that?
Well, the Dublin thing is a big thing too, because I was very influenced by my paternal grandparents and always very struck by their wit and the era of Dublin that they were young in, which is what this would be, this era. And I always, the story The Dead, the aunts in the story The Dead always reminded me of my own kind of paternal, like, aunts and uncles and granny and granddad. And in fact, the film of The Dead, when they're in that house, the Georgian house, and the piano's playing, and the lot of the carry-on of them sort of reminded me of that. So I always kind of wanted to capture that Dublin, the spirit of the era. But a personal thing that happened was my father was in the Mater Hospital, my elderly father, and he's recovered, but he was in the Mater Hospital for quite a long stretch of time. And I constantly was walking from O'Connell Street, which became to my mind Sackville Street, which is what you, and crossing Dorset Street up to Eccles Street. And I spent so much time on there, and the Georgian houses reminded me of the ones in The Dead. And I started to imagine my story unfolding within those houses.
Ah, right. So it was those nightly or daily walks that brought you into the location, and the location brought you back in time. The idea of the healer, was there any aspect of that, or what interested you about this idea of, you know, that the laying of hands could, some people felt at the time, could cure people?
Yeah, well, that I actually kind of took. So Rosaline starts off with the sight. But because she meets the mesmerist, she becomes revered by them. You know, she actually becomes famous within Dublin as a great Dublin mystic. But because she becomes famed, people start to maybe attribute to her gifts that she may or may not have. And the question is, does she start to believe them herself? You know, does she believe it herself? Does she become so swollen with the accolades that she's getting, that she starts to believe in her ability to lay on hands and to heal. That all starts to unfold in the book.
Yeah, and there is a debate around that, because there's a local doctor who lives nearby, and he's very much the science side of things, whereas Rosaline, or the Rose as she's called at this stage, by many of them, that she's very much on the healing side of things. But I did wonder what part hubris and pride, what part that played in your telling of this story, or what you wanted to explore around that theme.
Well, hubris and pride, yeah. I mean, when somebody's acclaimed so much, they start to believe their own, you know, their own press, basically, or she certainly does. And she starts to become swollen with ego and actually starts, I believe, to lose touch with her own natural gift. But what I was exploring also was that this, we were talking about modernity, this was the start of science, the start of vaccinations, the start of looking into antibiotics. They had just discovered the magic bullet for syphilis. Things were going full speed ahead, and the mesmerists wanted to stay with nature and the natural remedies of the 1800s. And what I kind of wanted to get across, I think, in the book is, let's look at this. I mean, the thing is, only less than 100 years ago, there is a character in it that dies from the prick of a rose, because he gets sepsis, it pricks his finger, he dies. And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to say, look, less than 100 years ago, we could die from something as simply as pricking your finger on a thorn. And people frequently did. They died constantly from infection. They hardly lived past 40. And infant death was huge. And when people are talking about going back to the natural ways, I really think they believe they're talking about going back to ancient ways. They're not. This was the medicine that was practiced in the early 1800s. And I think we need to be aware of that's what was practiced, is the, you know, and that what we have now, the medicine that we have now, when antibiotics came, they were a game changer. You know, we started saving lives, and now we're living till 90 or 100 because of it.
One final question on the subject of, and I suppose it's the character of Lawrence, isn't it? Or Lorcan, sorry, Lorcan Mulhern, who's the kind of the Republic nationalist side of it, and somebody who Rosaline becomes involved with. Yeah. That historical side of it, what aspect of that revolutionary period appealed to you in the telling of this story?
Well, I think I was very taken with the thing that I always I got caught up with was Maud Gonne and her Daughters of Ireland. That really kind of inspired me a lot. You know, I think that's beautiful, Daughters of Ireland. You know,
Enya so, Heron, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, the whole romance of that, you know, Yeats being in love with her, writing Kathleen O'Houlihan so she could star in it, then his distress when the rebellion actually happened in 1916, feeling guilty, he thought he had inspired people, you know, to take up arms and die. He thought, in a way, he was responsible for what had happened. And so it was that, the Maud Gonne and the Daughters of Ireland, and then the Countess Markovitch as well. So very much the women warriors of the time. And there were many women warriors so they feature quite a bit in the book.
Yeah, it really evokes that period very well, and the role that women played, as you say, in the revolutionary period. Siobhan, thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sean.
Not at all. That's Siobhan McGowan there, and Siobhan's new novel, The Graces, is published by Welbeck. Few artists have been as relentlessly mythologized as Nick Drake when he died in 1974 from an overdose. He was just 26. He made three albums, all of which had been commercial failures. Drake's death passed largely unnoticed in the music world, but as is so often the case, it took a few years for his genius to be recognized, for his name to be cited by young musicians as an influence, and his slim body of work to be repackaged. Drake's life has been chronicled at length before, but the exhaustive Nick Drake, The Life by Richard Morton Jack, regular contributor to music magazines, will possibly stand out as the definitive account. And Peter Murphy has been reading it for us, and he's with me in studio this evening. I suppose, Peter, it is impossible when you think of Nick Drake, the death at the age of 26 is practically the first thing that springs to mind, and the accompanying mythology. Richard Morton Jack, he's all about debunking lots of parts of that mythology, is he?
Yeah, there's almost a school of these figures, the sort of cursed poet figures in the late 60s and early 70s, Townes Van Zandt and Tim Harden and Tim Buckley, even all these sort of sensitive, visionary songwriters who were doomed for whatever reason to have short lives. The really fascinating thing about this biography is for the first 200 or 300 pages, one is left wondering what was the problem here, because this was a very well-adjusted, quiet, introverted, but wry, engaged and popular human being.
From a family where creativity was encouraged and nurture was given to in a wonderful way.
His mother, Molly, actually has a cult following of her own. I was writing about this book recently, and more than one musician friend of mine had commented online, you know, have you checked out Molly's work? Because she was a really beautiful songwriter. And his father, Rodney, was an extremely successful engineer who worked in Burma and came home. Nick Drake himself was born in Burma, now Myanmar. His father worked for a Bombay engineering company, made quite a lot of money, came home, was really interested in new developments in technology, so was well up on the latest gizmos, which would have been, you know, record players or whatever at the time. Molly was a beautiful songwriter, and Richard Morton Jack makes a great play of giving Molly her due in terms of passing on her musical gifts to her son. Yeah. And they're not dissimilar in terms of a certain imagistic, subtle poetry. You don't often know what a Nick Drake song is about,
no,
but you feel it in your bones.
Yeah, well, it's that poetic aspect, isn't it?
He owns a mood. It's a sort of late 60s, early 70s, pastoral melancholia, ruminative, autumnal. You know, as soon as you mention his name, as soon as you, like many people would have first encountered him through Pink Moon, which was used in a car advert in the late 90s, that combined with the beautiful, almost baroque string arrangements and his guitar playing.
The first album was Five Leaves Left. It was in 1969. How out of the blue did this kind of musical career come? I mean, he came from that lovely background that you describe. They were comfortable at the very least. They weren't hugely wealthy, but they were certainly comfortable. And he had that musical background, particularly from his mother's father, some musical ability, I think, as well, did he?
Yes.
Did he?
His father was musical, certainly as a listener, if not a player.
Yeah. So where did the Nick Drake, I'm going to be a singer-songwriter, when did that Nick Drake start to show its head or his head?
In his teenage years, he began to kind of stay in his bedroom, or was quite happy to entertain himself by obsessively pursuing core voicings and interesting chords. And most musicians, especially guitarists you talk to, will talk about his incredible plucking style. He's been compared almost to Robert Johnson in the way that you can create an orchestral sound just from the use of fingers and chord voicings. So he had that 10,000 hours thing of
he'd done the time.
He practiced and practiced and practiced, but he was notoriously disinclined to pursue anything else. I mean, his academic career, he didn't make it into Cambridge, so he went to a lesser sort of college in the Cambridge area and really could not be coerced into doing anything he did not want to do.
Time Has Told Me is the track we have from Five Leaves Left, first album of Nick Drake's from 1969. And off, he is off on another little modulation into another key. Just saying, as we're listening to Time Has Told there with Nick Drake, this is Peter Murphy with me this evening talking about Nick Drake, the life, new biography by Richard Morton Jack. The chordal modulations there, the way he's moving around, it's hugely inventive, and it sounds like two guitars is that he's playing as well.
Yeah, he was quite well versed in the classical musicians in Beethoven and Baroque music, but also he travelled quite a bit. For such an introvert, he made it as far as Morocco while the Rolling Stones were there, and he would take off at a minute's notice and hitchhike around France and busk for a living, basically. But he was surrounded by, as all great musicians inevitably are, an incredible team of people. So Joe Boyd, who was like the folk rock producer of the late 60s, Fairport Convention and all that school of Island Record bands. And his engineer, John Wood, was a gifted engineer.
We can hear it. Even these are probably remastered or remixed versions of the songs. But if it wasn't recorded properly in the first place, you can't do anything with it.
Yes, they're immaculately recorded. But everybody who worked with him said that he was an immaculate performer in the studio, he was usually the last person they'd have a problem with. Also, his schoolmate, Robert Kirby, ended up doing the string arrangements over far higher priced session people who tended to be more syrupy or a little less original.
So it wasn't a huge success, or certainly not a huge critical or commercial success. Five Leaves Left, Brighter Later, I think, was even more difficult for him than that first album, with Brighter Later being the second album from 1970.
Yeah, he signed to Island Records, you know, which at the time Chris Blackwell's label was just starting up, and was maybe the most sympathetic artist label, and would continue to be for 15 or 20 years. But it was a double-edged sword because he was kind of coddled. He should have been sent out to do endless PR and touring. And he was just not a hardy enough creature to deal with the live circuit in the UK at the time.
And was it subsequent to Brighter Later, and this is what Richard Morton Jack gives us in the book. Was it subsequent to that things started to kind of unravel a little bit?
As early as the preparation for Brighter Later, which Joe Boyd had envisioned as maybe the first album was a little too sparse to get played on the radio, and there was a lot more instrumentation. To my ear, Brighter Later is a little over-arranged and overplayed. I prefer the first and the third records. But it soon became apparent that as they sent him out to do like the uni circuit and the... whereas people, his contemporaries, like Sandy Denny or John Martin, were far more hale and hearty.
They knew how to play that game.
They knew how to deal with those rooms shut them up.
Yeah, but I was guessing Nick Drake was in there, you know, with these quiet songs and nobody is quietening down to listen to them at all. That would break a soul like his.
That, and also that he wouldn't make eye contact and made absolutely no concessions towards showbiz. So that general sense of letdown after the first record began a slow, insidious feeling of withdrawing.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Northern Sky from Brighter Later, the second of Nick Drake's three albums.
Never felt magic crazy as this.
Northern Sky there, a little flavour of it from Brighter Later, Nick Drake's 1970 album. Peter Murphy with me in studio talking about a new biography of Nick Drake. And yeah, you do hear it. It's slightly more produced, that it's not. It doesn't have the rawness and openness really of the first record.
Yeah, I mean the and by contrast, Pink Moon, the last record, was done with him and the engineer and no one else. The record company didn't even know they were making it, and it is a masterpiece, even though a lot of people are very uncomfortable with it because it's a very raw
Well, maybe tell us the story, because we will finish up by listening to Pink Moon, but tell us what happens then. You suggested that things started to unravel as Brighter Later was being prepared. What happened in the period subsequent to that, and how bad did things get?
So they put him up in a flat on his own in London, and he drank a lot of tea. And he smoked some hashish or marijuana. A lot of people had the idea that perhaps that contributed to his ensuing depression. Doctors' reports at the time state that it was not an excessive amount of consumption and that it was unlikely to have majorly contributed to his deterioration. He became chronically depressed, more and more introverted and withdrawn from the world. And the depression segued into something that was, it was a diagnosis of simple schizophrenia, which was something I was never aware of before. Basically, it's a dissociative state that does not involve oral or visual hallucinations, but does involve an increased inability to communicate with the outside world.
And through all of this, his mother and father, hugely supportive. They knew something was wrong. They were trying to get him the help that would get him out of this situation. Mm-hmm. But no. So what were the circumstances? Does Morton Jack bring us into the specifics of the circumstances around his death? Does he conjecture about how accidental or otherwise it may or may not have been?
Yes. Having read it at length, I'm still terminally ambivalent as to what happened. I am. It's quite likely that in a moment of extreme despair or on a whim, that he may have overdosed on the antidepressants that he was taking. And there is some sense that the use of antidepressants at the time was still very much in its infancy, or was a very unwieldy form of treatment, since become much more sophisticated. But he did go home to live with his parents. And the last 100 or 200 pages are quite difficult reading. Yeah. They really were heroic, his parents, in their support and in doing, and his sister Gabrielle, who's a successful actress at the time and has written her own memoir. It was a very slow decline, and he descended into a state of anhedonia. He was incapable of feeling joy by the end. Yeah. And there's a chilling image where there's a bonfire in the back garden towards the end, and he heaves his guitars onto them.
Very sad stuff. Is this book worth reading, and then maybe set us up into Pink Moon? You've mentioned it a few times, Pink Moon from the final.
It is the album of the same name. If you have a remote interest in Nick Drake, this is the definitive. It may be more than you're willing for or able for, but you will never forget the experience of reading it. It reminded me of reading Heavier Than Heaven, Charles R. Cross's Kurt Cobain biography, in that I needed a good stiff whiskey after the end of it. Beverly Martin, John Martin's partner at the time, described Pink Moon as, she said, it's like the book of Revelation. It doesn't make any sense, and it's a manifestation of illness, of madness. When people are really ill, they don't know what they're saying. They don't hear what's coming out of their own mouth. I thought those songs, those words were the product of a sick person. I don't think Nick himself knew what he was driving at. I would contend that there's great beauty and great power in this work, but I guess her opinion of it was coloured by her knowledge of what was going on. But it's an interesting take on what sounds like a really still, beautiful and calm song.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way.
Pink Moon from Nick Drake, and my thanks to Peter Murphy, who was speaking to us about the book Nick Drake, The Life by Richard Morton Jack, which is published by John Murray Books. First produced as a radio play in 1954, Under Milkwood, written by Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, takes place in a small fishing village over 24 hours and draws you into the lives of its colourful inhabitants. This play for voices, as Thomas described it, has since been adapted for the stage, for film, more recently as a children's book by Welsh singer Kerris Matthews. Now, it is also the latest project undertaken by Blue Raincoat Theatre Company and directed by John Carty, who joins me now from our Sligo studios. John, this Under Milkwood and you, to me, kind of live in a similar type of world. How long have you wanted to direct and put this play on stage with Blue Raincoat?
Hiya, Sean. I was lost in Nick Drake there for a while. But it was actually suggested to me about 2 years ago. Niall Henry, the artistic director, came up with the idea, and he thought it was a good project for me. And so I took it on board. He said, yeah, let's go for it.
The reason I put it, I match you alongside it, is of course it is, as Dylan Thomas describes it, this play for voices. But there are these hugely colourful characters who exist within it. You know, cartoon-like is maybe a little unfair, but they're big and brash and colourful.
Beautiful characters, yeah,
in many ways. And the physicality of those characters was what struck me. Are you realising these characters physically on stage as well as the wonderful writing of Dylan Thomas?
Well, one would hope, I suppose, yeah. I mean, it is a play for voices and not necessarily meant to be realised as the author intended, but it lends itself to bringing them from his imagination into another imagination and bringing them to life for the audience. It's just an absolute wonder to see them be realised by the 31 local actors that are in the play. It's a joy.
Yeah, because I've said this in the lead into the programme tonight. I talked about hearing the words of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood spoken by the people of Sligo, because it's so Welsh in many ways, the language of Dylan Thomas. Did it transfer easily onto the Sligo voices, or, you know, are you using local accents as opposed to having everybody trying some version of a Welsh accent?
No, I mean, I think that's just going down a kind of a rabbit hole there in regards to that, because there's too much fun to be had otherwise, rather than trying to focus it in on people perfecting Welsh accents, you know, because it's all about sound. I think he said in the original production to the crew or the actors that were playing, he said, love the words. And if you can love the words and bring out the beauty of them, then the job is done, and no matter what accent it's done in, you know.
And did you see, I mean, I suppose the rural setting of Under Milkwood, Clangarrub, people can spell
Clarigub,
that.
Clarigub.
Clangarrub. Oh, see, you say it again for me?
Well, as in where the town is.
Yes.
Clarigub.
Clarigub. And
yeah,
you can
it's
work
actually,
out,
well, you know, it's interestingly, it's actually bugger all. Backwards, yeah.
Which has said us a lot about
where he was coming from, yeah. You know?
But I wondered if you saw that Welsh fishing village that he creates in the story. Yeah. Could it be, you know, any fishing village around the Irish or British coast?
And the characters that inhabit that village could be any village, either coastal or inland, throughout the west coast of Ireland and beyond, like. No problem. Like, yeah.
Give me a sense of who Mr. Edwards and Miss Price are.
Who they are?
Yeah, the characters now.
Well, one of them is a draper who owns a local drapery shop, and the other is a sweet shop owner. And basically, they are sending love letters to each other and all the time. But in many ways, their love will never be realised. Although the section you're probably going to hear is where Miss Price actually wakes up as a dream. So this is what she imagines it is, but in reality, I don't think they'll ever see each other.
They'll never see this. They'll never see this in reality. This is Mr. Edwards and Miss Price, and it's Niall Collery and Sarah Ellis are the two performers here.
Yeah.
M'Fanway Price.
Mr. Mog Edwards.
I am a draper mad with love. I love you more than all the flannelette and calico, candlewick, dimity, crash and merino, tussor, cretonne, crepon, muslin, poplin, ticking and twilling the whole cloth hall of the world. I have come to take you away to my emporium on the hill. Throw away your little bed socks and your Welsh wool knitted jacket. I will heat the sheets like an electric toaster. I will lie by your side like the Sunday roast.
I will knit you a wallet of forget-me-not blue for the money to be comfy. I will warm your heart by the fire so you can slip it in under your vest when the shop is closed.
No, M'Fanway, M'Fanway, before the mice gnaw at your bottom drawer, will you say...
Yes, Mog, yes, Mog, yes, yes, yes!
And all the bells of the tills of the town will ring for our wedding.
That's Mr. Edgerton, Miss Price from Under Milkwood, and this from the upcoming Blue Room Court Theatre production. We heard Niall Collery there as Mr. Edwards.
Cleary, yeah.
Cleary, is that who you say? I beg your pardon. Niall Collery as Mr. Edwards and Sarah Ellis as Miss Price. And as I was listening to it, that list of the various types of materials that Niall listed off, and then the several yes, yes, yeses of Sarah as Miss Price at the end, it's hard not to hear Joyce and that kind of use of language in it, isn't it?
Yeah, just that little bit, actually. You know, it does remind you of Molly's soliloquy, all right, yeah. But his playfulness with words is beyond. Like, it's brilliant. Throughout all the different characters and the voice as well, too. You know, he just, his use of words and his, but it, I suppose, as opposed to the lyricism, I was just struck myself with the playfulness that he had, that I wouldn't necessarily have been aware of until you go into the depths of it.
Yeah, because
you know?
there is a lot of fun right across.
Fun to be had, yeah.
All the stories within it. But interestingly enough, I suppose most people, when they hear Under Milkwood, will think of Richard Burton and that wonderful voice of his narrating, because it is a narrator who brings us through the Dylan Thomas, I suppose, the original version of it, if you like, or the version for radio. You don't have one single narrator. You're sharing that out. Just explain that to me, John.
Well, I mean, there's 31 actors in the production, and I just thought it was in the spirit of the production to be as inclusive as possible. Do you know what I mean? Because, so therefore, if you just give that to one person, it doesn't really, it's about spreading the love, really, to be honest with you, you know. And because when you're listening to it, you get a sense maybe of the one voice, but in a production, you're happy to actually hear it from all different sides and diversity, you know.
Right, we'll finish up by listening to a little bit of Mr. and Mrs. Pugh. their situation here, you wouldn't want to be eating anything that Mrs. Pugh gives you, really, would you?
Oh, well, Mr. Pugh, actually.
Oh, Mr. Pugh is the poisoner,
Mrs.
Pugh is the one that has to watch out.
She has to examine her plate before she eats, I think.
Right,
you know?
Okay. Well, the voice that we'll hear, narrator voice here, is Aisling Mannion, Mr. Pugh, Alton Burke, Mrs. Pugh, Orla McSharry, and Mary Ann Sailors, played by Mary Walsh or Welsh? Which is
Walsh,
she? Mary Walsh. Mary Walsh. Here we go.
Mr. Pugh, in the schoolhouse opposite, takes up the morning tea to Mrs. Pugh and whispers on the stairs.
Here's your arsenic, dear, and your weed killer biscuit. I've throttled your parakeet. I've spat in the vases. I've put cheese in the mouse holes. Here's your nice tea, dear.
Too much sugar.
But you haven't tasted it yet, dear.
Too much milk, then. Has Mr. Jenkins said his poetry?
Yes, dear.
Then it's time to get up. Give me my glasses. No, not my reading glasses. I want to look out. I want to see.
She sees Mary Ann Sailors opening her bedroom window above the tap room and calling to the heavens.
I'm 85 years, 3 months and a day, and this is the Garden of Eden.
I will say this for her. She never makes a mistake.
Mary Ann Sailors, played by Mary Walsh. Mr. and Mrs. Pugh, played by Alton Burke and Orla McSharry, respectively, in the voice that you heard narrating Aisling Mannion. And that Sligo version of Under Milkwood, produced by Blue Green Cut Theatre Company. Performances take place in the Factory Performance Space from Wednesday the 28th through until Friday the 30th as part of the Cardiff Sligo Arts Festival, as well on Saturday the 1st of July. Cardiff Sligo Arts Festival runs from July the 1st through to the 9th. CardiffFestival.com for full details. And thanks to John Carty for being with us this Monday evening to speak about that.